as I started, I was mentioned that normally I've been covering 2 Samuel for, I don't know how long it's been, months, if not probably a year borderline. Unfortunately, I cannot continue on to 2 Samuel 15 without telling you how to read 2 Samuel 15 and 16 and 17 and 18, 19 and 20 and 21. Because unfortunately, most of us read it in English. No offense to anybody who reads in English. Most of us also who can read Hebrew could read it in Hebrew too, but that doesn't help you. Unfortunately, I have to tell you a foundation to begin before we actually cover Samuel 15. If I don't set the foundation, I'm going to lose you very, very quickly. If you don't mind, I'll start with a prayer. Almighty God, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, we ask your blessing today that you'll open our hearts and minds to you. Give us peace, God. Help us to see and understand, to worship and to love. Have open hearts toward your will and toward your instruction. We ask this in the name of your Son, Yeshua HaMashiach. Amen. As you notice on my board here, I have nothing but New Testament books and chapters written up. That's done there for a reason. Because as you know, those of you who have been following me the last number of years, for the most part, but really the last few months, since, I guess, what, feast or so, we're discussing a lot of regarding how 2 Samuel 15 through 21 is a dead match to the gospel in chronological order. And I'm going to instruct you and show you, which will be very obvious to see once we get there. But before I get there, as I mentioned 2 weeks ago, I'm going to give you a list of what to actually look for. My list I wrote down so far only contains 35 dead matches. From 16 to 15 through 21, that contains just the section of Messiah actually being arrested to his resurrection. Now, those 35 dead matches, I mean, they're in chronological order. They're plain as day once you know what to look for. But I'm going to list them out for you today. So I wrote these books down here. These are Luke 22, John 18, and Matthew 26, where most of these matches occur. A couple of them occur in the book of Acts as well. We're not going to cover that today because I don't think I'll get to it. But I intend to instruct you as best I can to what I'll be telling you over the next few months and what we'll be reading and observing in 2 Samuel. Unfortunately, I did not type this up yet. I've not dedicated enough time this past couple weeks to typing this stuff away and do this stuff all done ahead of time like I should have. God willing, if all goes well, the next one up here, you'll have a nice typed out sheet that I can hand out to you. So you guys have to bear with me. First of all, this question has been asked many times in the past, somewhat half-heartedly and sometimes more sincere. What is the gospel? I'm not going to sit there and go through the definition of you for what is the gospel. I'm going to define for you what the book of Luke says was the important message that is going to be that is being duplicated in 2 Samuel. This important message occurs in Luke chapter 24. So you don't mind, go there real quick. I'm not going to read the whole chapter. Luke 24, verse 44, the Messiah says certain words, says certain phrases. This is a sequence of important things he wants to get across to his disciples. Well, these phrases is what we are, is a thrust, the goal, the overarching desire for us as we're reaching and reading through 2 Samuel. We were looking for this information. This information contains in chapter 24 of Luke, verse 44. And he said unto them, "These are the words which I spoke to you while I was still with you, that all things must be fulfilled which were written in the law of Moses, the prophets, and the Psalms concerning me." And he opened their understanding that they might comprehend the scriptures. Then he said to them, "Thus it is written, and thus it was necessary for the Christ to suffer and to rise from the dead on the third day, and that repentance and remission of sins we preached in his name to all nations beginning at Jerusalem. And you are witness of these things." What did Messiah just list off to them? Three things. Three things he listed to them that the law of Moses, the prophets, and the Psalms all tell about. And 2 Samuel lays out for you in a play form. Messiah would suffer and die, I could say there's one thing. You may argue with the two, but I could say there's one thing. He would rise from the dead, and repentance and remission of sins would be preached, or accomplished, or spoken, or done. Those three things we must see, and we're going to see, in 2 Samuel 15 through 21. Someone's going to die, there's going to be a resurrection, there's going to be a remission of sin. And number three shows up a lot of times for 3 days. And three people, a lot of threes. So now I'm going to ask you a few questions. Question number one. Most of you were aware that I was spent a lot of time focusing on Amnon and Tamar, focusing on David and Bathsheba, and Adam and Eve, and matching them, I thought, pretty decently, thematically tied together. I spent a lot of time on there for one purpose, to get you the idea that these three events were tied together through a satanically inspired event. Satanically inspired event. An event that Satan was involved with in order to accomplish his goal. Adam and Eve was quite clear. It was obvious. Satan was right there. He's talking. Well, with David and Bathsheba, we noted so many parallel links between all of these that there was a deception going on by David, who was called cunning, just like the Satan was called cunning. And of course, with Amnon and Tamar, we had Jonadab, who was also called cunning and contrived this wonderful, elaborate scheme in order to allow what was evil to be considered good and what was good to be considered evil. All three accomplished one task. They create a catalytic event. Catalyst. For the gospel. What was the catalyst for the beginning of Messiah's suffering? I'll give you a hint. The same catalyst for Adam and Eve, the same catalyst for David and Bathsheba, and the same catalyst for Amnon and Tamar. What was the event that that started the ball rolling, Messiah's suffering?
When Satan entered into Judas to go turn him in.
Exactly. That is the beginning of Messiah's suffering. He preached before that. People ridiculed him. No. Ridicule is nothing compared to what he went through with the whole suffering of actually beating up, bloodied up, dying. That's actual real suffering, not public humiliation, people not considering him worthwhile. That's different. So Messiah's suffering, the actual biggest main event occurred when Satan entered Judas Iscariot. Luke 22. I spent a lot of time on this because that's our beginning point. That's our stone step number one through 2 Samuel. Luke 2, beginning verse 1. Now the feast of unleavened bread drew near, which was called Passover. The chief priests and the scribes sought how they might kill him, for they feared the people. Then Satan entered Judas, surnamed Iscariot, who was numbered among the 12. So he went his way and conferred with the chief priests and captains how he might betray him to them. And they were glad and agreed to give him money. Then he promised and sought opportunity to betray him in the absence of the multitude. This also is recorded in John 13, which is going to go there too. John 13. Yeah, I've written up there for 18. We're just going to John 13 first. 13 verse 21. And when Jesus said these things, he was troubled in spirit and testified, "Most surely I say to you, one of you will betray me." The disciples looked at one another, perplexed at whom it might be. Now there was leaning on Jesus' bosom one of the disciples whom Jesus loved, and Simon Peter therefore motioned to him and asked who it was of whom he spoke. Then leaning back, Jesus' breast, he said to him, "Lord, who is it?" Jesus answered, "It is he whom I shall give a piece of bread when I have dipped it." And having dipped the bread, he gave it to Judas Iscariot, the son of Simon. Now after the piece of bread, Satan entered him, and Jesus said to him, "What you do, do quickly." But no one at the table knew for what reason he had said this to him. For some thought because Judas had the money box, that Jesus had said to him, "Buy things we need for the feast," or that he should have given something to the poor. Having received the piece of bread, he went immediately, and it was night. That is the beginning point. The Messiah is now interacting with Satan. There's a dichotomy or a polar scenario going on here. That is the same beginning point with Adam and Eve, David, Bathsheba, and Amnon, Tamar. It's the same event. What was once good is now being turned to evil in order to accomplish something which is even more evil, which ultimately turns into a good, but we'll get that later. It gets confusing. What's the next events that happen? These are the events we're going to start reading in 2 Samuel 15. After Judas Iscariot leaves. So that was a catalyst event. I want to discuss that. Make sure that's fresh and solid in your mind. Satan is involved in all of this. We're going to start out in... Yeah, we'll do Luke 20. Stay in Luke 22. Or go back to Luke 22 if you're not there. The main event, I should say, that begins in chapter 15 of 2 Samuel, that you're going to be looking for when you're reading it. We're going to read Luke 22, verse 24. This event we want to read in 2 Samuel as well, when we get there. But there was also rivalry among them, as to which of them would be considered the greatest. And it said to them, the kings of the Gentiles exercise lordship over them, and those who exercise authority over them are called benefactors. But not so among you. On the contrary, he who is greatest among you, let him be as the younger, and he who governs as he who serves. For the greater, he who sits at the table or he who serves? Is not he who sits at the table? Yet I am among you as the one who serves. But you are those who have continued with me in my trials, and I bestow upon you a kingdom, just as my Father bestowed one upon me, that you may eat, drink at my table in my kingdom, and sit at the thrones, judging the 12 tribes of Israel. So I expect to read in 2 Samuel 15 a rivalry, as is written here. I expect to see individuals loyal to David, competing with one another, but who is greater? Who should be with him and who should not be? I expect to see that. I expected David's response to be compassion toward those who are suffering or going along with him. As he points out here, those who are with me during my trials. I expect that response to be read in 2 Samuel 15. Those are two duplicates we're going to read again. Verse 31. And Lord said, Simon, Simon, indeed, Satan has asked for you that he may sift you as wheat. But I have prayed for you that your faith should not fail. And when you have returned to me, strengthen your brethren. But he said to him, Lord, I am ready to go with you both to prison and to death. And said, I tell you, Peter, the rooster will not crow this day before you will deny me three times that you know me. The event we're looking for in this is the individuals who are dedicating their lives to David are going to say the same thing. I will go with you into prison and to death. Declaring that. Not just one individual, as Peter's recorded, because Matthew and Mark recorded that all the disciples said the same thing. They all agree with Peter. We will all go with you unto death. We expect to see that in 2 Samuel. Let's go to John 18. You're going to see this too in 2 Samuel. John 18, starting in verse 1. When Jesus had spoken these words, he went out with his disciples over the brook Kidron, where there was a garden which he and his disciples entered. You're going to see David and his men, who are his disciples, crossing immediately. This is the sequential order, by the way. It's chronological order of events in 2 Samuel. They will cross the brook Kidron, fleeing to the Mount of Olives. David and his men will do so, just like Messiah and his men are doing so. You will see that there will be a garden, or actually a location, which David is accustomed to stopping with his men. He will pray to God there. Guess what? Looks like Messiah did the same thing. He goes to a garden on the Mount of Olives, by the way, because you don't know where that's at. And it points out here in verse 2. And Judas who betrayed him also is a place where Jesus often met there with his disciples. In 2 Samuel, it records that David likes this particular place on the Mount of Olives, that he often goes there and prays to God with, at that one spot. As was David's custom, so was Messiah's custom. Scoot down a little further on. Go back to Luke 22. This may seem a little odd to you why I'm going through this and how I'm going through it, but it's important. 22. Verse 43. You see, when Messiah goes off and he prays, he's we read the story, he goes off three different times and praying, oh God, please take this burden away from me. It points out here in verse 43, no greater, Luke's the only one who records this, but I'm reading this for a reason. So then an angel appeared to him, referring to Messiah, from heaven, having strengthening him. And being in agony, he prayed more earnestly, and his sweat became like great drops of blood falling down to the ground. You're going to see David, while he's still on Mount of Olives, praying to God, asking for him to take this away from him, this burden. A messenger is going to come to David and strengthen him. Just as this messenger came to Messiah, strengthened him. It's in chronological order, of course. Continuing on in Luke 22, start going down to verse 47. While he was still speaking, behold, a multitude, those who called, and he who was called Judas, the one of the 12, would be for him, and drew near to Jesus to kiss him. And Jesus said to Judas, Judas, are you betraying the Son of Man with a kiss? You're going to see David and his men, while they're on Mount of Olives, praying to God, grieving their flight. One's going to come to David and be insincere with his devotion. A kiss of death is insincere. A individual who declares their loyalty and is lying to you during the process is insincere. You're going to see an individual do that. Just as it happened to David, so it's going to happen to Messiah. Vice versa. These are duplicates of each other. The individual who is insincere to both Messiah and the one insincere to David are motivated by the exact same thing. Money. So the individual who is betraying Messiah and the individual who betrays David or lies to David both gain something out of it. They get the same thing. Wealth. Personal gain. This may seem boring, I realize that, but bear with me. Continuing on. In Luke, verse 47. When he's still speaking... A little further down than 47. Verse 50. I apologize. Actually, take that back. Verse 49, it's more important. When those around him saw what was going to happen, they said to him, Lord, shall we strike with the sword? And one of them struck the servant of the high priest and cut off his right ear. And Jesus' response was very important. Jesus answered and said, permit even this. And he touched his ear and healed him. You're going to see in 2 Samuel, one of David's men come to David and say, this man is evil to you. Let me cut off his head. He'll draw his sword, and David will look to his man and say, no, put your sword away. Continuing on. Messiah responded here, permit even this. You know the response? David's response to his, I guess, his servant or his warrior will be the same. Permit even this. This individual who is ridiculing me, who is attacking me, who is assaulting me, who is sinning toward me, permit it. It is acceptable and holy unto God. The same response, same words. We responded to one another. You're going to continue on saying more. Let's go over to Matthew 26. Verse 59. Actually, let's back up. Well, I'll loop verse 58 to, well, I'll start at verse 57 because it's a good place to start. Those who laid hold of Jesus led him away to Caiaphas, the high priest. The scribes and the elders were assembled together. But Peter followed him at a distance to the high priest's courtyard, and he went in and sat with the servants to see the end. The chief priests, the elders, and all the council sought false testimony against Jesus to put him to death, but found none. Even though many false witnesses came forward, they found none. But the last two false witnesses came forward. But at last, falsely. You're going to see a council being brought forward of individuals trying to figure out how to kill David, just as this council was brought forward. And they will have false testimony. One false testimony, if they followed it, would have been good. Meaning, would have been successful. But the other false testimony they followed, of course, for them, it was unsuccessful. But they both received, the council itself, in order to find ways of killing David, received false testimony. They searched for it. They found it. Just as written here, so it is written in 2 Samuel. As you recall, Messiah told his disciples, you will abandon me, you will deny me. Your disciples, they will flee. Well, just so happens that in David's case, his companions, his disciples, if you worship through that word, will also flee, just as Messiah's fleet. They will deny him just as he has denied him. The betrayer, Judas Iscariot for Messiah, finds out or realizes, comes to his senses, this was wrong. I did something unholy. He will attempt to go back and rectify it. Judas did that. Well, in David's time, the individual who betrays him realizes, I made a mistake. He will set his family's affairs in order and go hang himself, just as Judas Iscariot did. Attempted to go back and rectify it, set his affairs in order, and hung himself. They will bury they'll bury David's betrayer's body. They'll discuss the fact they buried his body. They'll discuss Judas's dead body or a place to put bodies. And there'll be shekels of silver regarding for both individuals. There'll be a price put upon Messiah's head, as it was, 30 pieces of silver, and there's a price upon David's head, same pieces of silver. Messiah continues on, as you recall, he goes through his various torments and the trials, and they discuss him. He's dragging his cross up the stake, or whatever you wish to call it, doesn't make a difference. He'll be exhausted. He'll be worn out. Individual will come, and as you recall, Messiah is assigned, please carry this cross, this stake, and carry it for him. Well, in David's case, the exact thing is going to happen. Because during his flee, during his problems, his men are exhausted. They're out of food, they're out of water. They're dying. An individual comes, who happens to have two donkeys, and saves him and his men. Gives them strength and renews them all over again. As you recall, Judas was replaced when he was killed, when he died. As will the replacement for David as well. The betrayer. If you recall, Messiah dies with three men. Two men. The three people die, but two men go with him. Or during David's time, three die, two come back. Did you know what Messiah told the two that were with him? The one who believed, you'll be with me. You will be resurrected. The one who didn't believe, different story. Same thing happens. Three die, two come back. David, three die, two come back. The dead body, of course, will be thrown into a grave and covered up. For both during David's time as well as Messiah's time. Covered by a boulder or rocks. 3 days later, Messiah is restored to life. Right? We know that part. Well, it just so happens. The same thing happens to David. He is restored to full strength after three. Messiah's death is called the gospel, the good news. David will call the death of his son the good news, the gospel. The Messiah's death, if you recall, the king, meaning God the Father, grieved greatly. You know, hailstones, a lot of people died during that process. During David's suffering, the death of the Messiah caused David to grieve. So much so that his men were confused. Did you not conquer your greatest enemy? Did not Messiah conquer the greatest enemy? The grief is mixed in good news. Messiah, of course, killed on a cross or a tree or a stake, whatever you word it. We should wish to word it. The individual in David's time done the same. The crucified dies on a tree. His bones were not to be broken. The Messiah, remember that? Bones not to be broken, they didn't break his legs. Well, in David's time, he's commanded, take care of the body, care that it's not damaged. Forces of nature kill most of the people during David's time, during this battle, the sequence of events. What force of nature killed a lot of people during Messiah's time? As I mentioned, hail did. God. Another word wording it. God killed most of the people. God killed during David's time. God killed during Messiah's time. He was angry. He would grieve. Messiah, of course, wins the greatest battle of all over death. David, of course, also wins the greatest battle. But the unique thing is, which I mentioned just a few minutes ago, that David's men were confused. They're going to their king, you've accomplished and defeated your greatest enemy. And yet you grieve and make all of us grieve. And we were successful. These are the words, David, you're shaming us. And you think about shame. Were Messiah's men shamed after his death? Yes, they were. They were hidden. They were hiding themselves. When Messiah came back from the dead 3 days later, I don't know how much time left before we actually saw the guys or not, but he came back and they were all hiding in locked rooms because they were shamed, humiliated. Yet their king defeated the greatest enemy possible, and yet they were the ones humiliated. David did the exact same thing. He and his men defeated their greatest enemy, and yet they are the ones humiliated, not the enemy. The disciples at first did not receive Messiah back. They were confused. Wait a minute, are you really him? Are you really the actual one I think you are? Until you actually touch his bone, touch his flesh. David's men did the exact same thing. When they saw David, they said, wait a minute, are you really back? Are you really king? And David said, I am your bone, I am your flesh. Just as Messiah said, I have bone and flesh. Touch it. I'm here, I really am here. You know, after Messiah's death, one of the big things we just read in Luke 24 was that it's a death, burial, and then the resurrection of 3 days, but the remission of sins has to follow the suit. It commands them all the disciples to go forth. The Messiah accomplished it. He killed death. He killed the worst thing you could possibly do, and yet now the real work begins, the remission of sins. And what did David do after he is resurrected, to use that term? He forgives everyone their sins. Everyone who went against him, everyone who argued with him, who purposefully sinned against him, he said, Your sin, though, is unto death. As this is David's word. Your sin's unto death. No one will put to death for this. You're free, just as Messiah did. Messiah, of course, not supposed to remember our sins ever again either. Just so happens, the one person who should be put to death in David's time, he asks David, please, don't remember my sins ever again. And David agrees. He'll remember no more. Blessings are brought forth from David for all who stood with him, even those who somewhat faltered, but still believed. He blesses each and every one of them. May Messiah find that same when he returns in us. Any questions so far? I know this is kind of a little abstract.
David left 10 wives.
Yes, he did.
What about them?
David did a lot of things. Keep in mind, there's a definite difference between an object and its shadow. I can get an idea of what the object looks like through a shadow, but I do not know what the object is. See, in the story of 2 Samuel, which I purposely have done this, and it made it sound confusing for a reason, because shadows are designed that way. If you just read 2 Samuel 15 to 21, you would not get half of what I just rattled off to you. Because I've read it a whole bunch of times. Guess what? I got about a third of it. You might get more. God bless you if you get more than that. But I got about a third of what I just rattled off to you by reading it myself. Because we read it as it's written, a play form. Well, that's a problem. Because we think of play as, well, it has a beginning. Oh, it has a climax. It has an end. I forgot the word for the end of a play. Anyway, there's a Greek word for it. There's a lot of things. Anyway, it has events or elements in a play. And that's how 2 Samuel is written. It's all nice and wonderful for us. The problem is, God doesn't necessarily teach that fashion. That's very chronological. A beginning, a middle, and an end. That's sequential events. Well, God teaches thematically, as far as I'm concerned. He says, look at this event. Oh, look how it looks just like that one. Learn from it. We do that ourselves. We read, Samson today. He mentioned him. Through his death, he saves Israel. We say, oh, wow, that's a lot like Messiah. Ooh, through his death, saves Israel. That's thematically tying them. Well, that's how 2 Samuel is actually written. It's written chronologically, but the elements are in them match the gospel. There's a reason why we're going through it in such great detail, because it's beautiful once you see it. This may not have been simple for you to rattle off. I realize I just read it to you. I didn't actually sit there and do a lot of proof. It's quite simple to read it. Just go through Luke 22 and John 18 and Matthew 26 and Mark 14. You read just the same thing I just read. Nothing new about it. But I want you to listen and recall at least part of what I wrote, said to you. I'll try to type it up to you next time up here. Because that'll help you to spot when you run across it in 2 Samuel to know what you're looking for. Because David is a shadow of the Messiah. He's not actually the Son of God. Well, he's going to do his own thing, but amongst the things he does, God's hand is written in it. Yes, Anne.
Where does Absalom fit in?
Absalom is all over it. The individual in David's time, because as I mentioned a couple of weeks ago, we have two messianic characters, four messianic characters in the same story during David. The deal being messianic characters that I'm doing something that Messiah is going to do right now. That may not be the same truth in 5 minutes from now, and it may not be the truth 4 minutes ago, but right now it is. I'm a messianic figure for that 5 minutes time slot. Somebody else, Job Bull number five, comes over there and says, okay, now I'm a messianic figure doing this event. You have characters showing up in David's time. They're all messianic figures. Absalom is one of the bigger ones.
He's in each and every event.
Yes, he's in each. Yeah, Messiah is in every event throughout 2 Samuel 15 to 21. It's just a different person doing it. That's the image of a shadow versus the actual object.
I was just kind of reflecting on my last question. I was thinking maybe the ten brides were of Israel.
We won't be discussing that just yet. I won't say that's cheating, but you're going somewhere where I don't want to cover just yet. That's not for a couple chapters still. I apologize for stopping you. He is right. There are elements to the 10 women left behind that have a very important function, what they're supposed to do and what happened to them, but we can't cover that today.
Okay, this is...
By all means, ask any question you have, because I purposely went through this knowing full well I couldn't touch section 15 until I covered this, so I know you guys have questions on what they just said.
This is a really embarrassing question.
By all means, ask anything.
I mean, why is this the comparison so important?
Comparison between 2 Samuel and Messiah?
You're comparing David to Messiah.
Yes.
Is that so that the Jewish people, I mean, what's the point of...
I will tell you my objective. Yes. I won't tell you yours or what God and else. My objective. I read a book 4, 5, 6 months ago. Oh, I forgot. A few months ago. It caught my attention. It's like, wait a minute. This could be a problem. This book, which I mentioned before to a number of you, it's not that it's well written or well done. It's just a book. The Islamic Antichrist by Joel, I forgot his last name. Robinson. I think it's Richardson. It caught my attention because it points out there's something about Islam that I was unaware of. I knew they believed in Jesus of some form. But I knew they also didn't believe he was a Messiah. He was just a guy. A prophet. I didn't know, until I read this book, that Islam has a certain information about this individual. That our Bible not does have, but calls him something different. It has an individual. This individual, he will come back. Jesus of Islam will come back from heaven, right down to the ground. Hey, that's our Bible's the same thing. And he's going to come along and say, and he's going to perform miracles, according to Islam. He'll be able to perform miracles in front of your face, your eyes. You'll be able to see them. And they won't be tricks of the looks. They'll actually really be miracles. And he will look at you and says, your Bible that records about me, and he'll be very convincing, records me incorrectly. He'll say that to you. He'll test you on that. And he'll be able to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that he's right and your Bible's wrong. Because he's an eyewitness and the Bible's not. Meaning you can't cross-examine this. And that caught my attention. So, wow. This individual in our Bible is noted as the prophet to the Antichrist. He's a prophet. Islam, this particular Jesus, is supposed to come around, and if you do not break your will or bend your will to what he has proven to you beyond any reasonable doubt, he has authority to kill you, behead you. And he'll have with him an item or an object that the actual real Antichrist will declare, this person believes you, Islamic Jesus, or this person does not believe you, Islamic Jesus. That sounds familiar. You know, there's somebody in the Revelation that's got the same thing. Has some unusual object that can tell this prophet whether the person is telling the truth or not, and that this person believes the prophet or doesn't believe the prophet. Funny, the Revelation says this person can behead you for it, too. After reading that book, I said, wait a minute. If an individual comes to me and says, I am the Jesus, can actually perform miracles to where everybody can see, can argue with me in the New Testament and prove every spot that it talks about him is incorrectly written and be convincing enough to, as it says, fool even the elect? If it were possible. Am I confident enough to say, I don't believe you, go ahead, behead my son? Am I that strong? I would like to think so, but am I? So you're thinking, all right, if these events are likely to occur, how can I say confidently and know full well, without fear, without concern, go ahead, behead my son? And his tearing eyes screaming at me saying, no, no, no. How do I get there? How do I become that confident? Simple. You see, the disciples of Messiah didn't prove themselves who they were by the New Testament. They proved themselves by the Old Testament. So if I can prove to this Islamic Jesus, in my own mind, of course, that I know he's lying because 2 Samuel proves he's lying. Ooh, that predates what this man's claiming he lived. And since 2 Samuel 15-21 is the most complete example of the Messiah ever written in the Bible, other than the gospel itself, I said, well, if I can, in my heart and mind, believe and know and prove beyond a reasonable doubt in 2 Samuel that all these events that are recorded about you, Islamic Jesus, were true, and according to 2 Samuel, they're true, I have two witnesses in the Bible to say this person in front of me is lying, as opposed to just one. Because the gospel itself are three men or four men watching the same thing. But now I've got a fifth person who watched it 800 years earlier. That made a profound impact on me. My goal is not to convert any human on earth. I don't care. My goal is not to make this comparison just for the fun of it. I don't care. My goal is to instill inside of me a foundation so strong that I know with confidence I kiss my son goodbye. It is a former Islamic, Christian now. Yes.
Well, you know, for years, you know, when you brought up that verse that when Yeshua rose from the dead, that he walked along with two of his disciples, and he opened their eyes to the scriptures about where it told about him. And for a long, yeah, as a Christian, it's like, where does it really? I mean, there are a couple places that you can point out, obviously, in the Psalms, and but
the easy ones.
The easy ones, right. But where else does it? And this is so cool. I love it. I think it's great.
And Messiah said the prophets, he is the most prophesied item in the entire Bible. He is in his line. Being the most prophesied item in the entire Bible, I expect to see it in almost every page. I mean, honestly. Be honest with yourself. If I say, you know what, this book contains the word letter A. I want to see the letter A on every page. Guess what? You know, I can do that. It's on every single page, there's letter A. In English, of course. I want to see the same thing about Messiah. I want to see him. Now, of course, as you know, I've been going through prophet study I forgot how long. And I started, of course, in, I think it was Joshua, and went all the way through Joshua and Judges and First Samuel, and now I'm going through 2 Samuel. What was the most important thing for them at their time? Was it about the last days? Was that what they all wanted to talk about? What game was that for them? Nothing. What was their objective when they wrote their prophets down? When they wrote their stories down, they wrote with God, the Messiah, and the next event about him, that he's going to come. Not that he's going to come again, no, that he's going to come first. The first event, because that's who they're talking to at first. Now, yes, the later prophets discuss the grander beyond that. But we're talking early prophets here. Joshua, Judges, Samuel, that's early. They're called for early for a reason. Their objective is to tell everybody about the first coming of the Messiah. Now that I've read through all this stuff and rattled all this stuff off, I'm going to walk you through 2 Samuel 15. Through thematic ties and chiastic structures, because they're the ones who map all this out. And since God inspired 2 Samuel, inspired the entire Bible for that matter, as far as I'm concerned, you can disagree, he wrote these stories down in the order that they're recorded. you will note that there are a lot of chronological errors. Well, that even didn't happen here. It happens way over here. Now you're going back in time. Funny things happen in 2 Samuel. That didn't happen sequentially. Realistically, actually, it tells you it didn't happen sequentially. It goes back and forth, jumps around. But yet it's written in that fashion. All for one objective. Point your attention to the biggest thing's about to show up, the Messiah. God writes in a funny fashion. It's our job, as far as I'm concerned, to find out why. To search him out. This may have been difficult for you to follow through, the stuff I rattled off in the testament. I will type this up, don't worry. It'll be a little bit easier. I'm just a very, very, very bad, very slow typer. I didn't allocate enough time to do that. But now that I've given you a list of what we're going to be looking for, when you read 2 Samuel, God willing, you'll spot it. Because if I want to be that strong and knowing what may happen to my family and having to possibly watch it, I want to make sure everybody in this room is equally that strong. It's really important to me. It may not be important to you or to God. It's what his plan is for your life. But that's my objective. Hopefully that answers your question as to why I'm making these bizarre parallels. I want to be strong in it. If I want to be strong in it, and since I'm the teacher, I'm going to make you strong in it if I can. Any other questions?
Something for you to look into, that's all?
By all means.
Okay. We have, at the time when the Messiah met everybody there in the on the day before Pentecost or time before Pentecost, there was 120 there. I find that fascinating because in the book of Ezra, there's 120 who put together what you're reading now in the fashion and the order which we are reading now. In other words, he was given a commandment to capture all these writings from another king, and he put them in, not necessarily chronological order, because they didn't think that way, but set them in pattern and pattern. It's like they were inspired to do it in a pattern form when they got all these writings put together at the same time. I was kind of curious about the very famous men during the time of Ezra established it, and kind of curious, were the 12 men very important men during the time of Ezra? That helped?
That's a question I don't think I could possibly answer.
Yeah.
First of all, there's nothing really written about those individuals or Ezra's time. Yes, it's in Jewish tradition literature, but there's not actual record, like independent record of them. So we don't think much about them, if anything at all about them. We know potentially what a few of them may have consisted of, but that's about it. As far as why there's 120 during the book of Acts, that has to do with the number 120. It's also similar to number 126. I think that's the right number. I think it's the number of fish that were caught. I can't remember. I think it's 126. 56? Thank you. 156. No, something like that. And that's the number itself. The numbers actually mean something. Not so much the individuals who were there, but the actual number itself means something. The 156 is Shekhinah. It was the Shekhinah. That's the Hebrew word for the glory of God. So 156, that the fish gathered together was to glorify God. That was the objective of the number. 120, I forgot what the 120 meant for. I apologize. I'd tell it to you if I remember. But it actually means something else. But that's the number. Yeah, right. That's a difficult loop to throw me for. Any other questions or comments? Because next time we're going to hit 2 Samuel 15 hard and fast. Bill.
Maybe not the time or place, but I can't let it go.
Go right ahead.
Well, that's an interesting speculation on the beast. But
right. It's just a book that I read. It's not that it's right. True, just that it caught my attention.
But we have to remember the most accurate description of that person that you talked about who's going to do the miracles is the second beast. There's a first beast that's over him, according to Revelation 13. But the thing is, this guy is accepted by the Jews to lead worship in the temple and to perform sacrifices. So it would be really a stretch of my imagination that it could be the Pope or a Muslim.
I wouldn't be a Pope at all, though.
Or a Muslim like that, because the Jews have to accept him, and he's going to do temple.
Yeah, it's an interesting theory. Now, that may be the case. I'm not going to argue that this individual, in fact, is the prophet to the beast. But because it caught my attention, it made me say, I need to build a stronger foundation of myself. I do believe you're probably absolutely right that there is less information, less truth in a messianic, or sorry, in a Islamic description than it would be in a biblical description of the same individual. But because there's something there that caught my attention, it made me reread part of Revelation's story. When I reread that, it made me think, I need to be stronger in this. Just because, even though I know full well the Bible does not record all details, it records just as much for you to see what's going on, then says, figure it out yourself. A lot more stuff happens than just what's written here. Not to say that everything in Islam is true or not, nothing of the sort. But there's enough demonic influence in how Islam began, its foundation, to I know the demons that were influencing its beginning were pretty strong and pretty knowledgeable. If they're knowledgeable, even Satan himself believes. If he believes, then he can create a duplicate or an alternate religion that would counteract it. I don't care, the details may be off, but enough of it is, I need to be something that's stronger than what he is. That's my personal opinion.
Yeshua told the Pharisees when he confronted them in John 5:39, he says to them, "You search the scriptures because you think that in them you have eternal life,
right,
and that it is they that bear witness about me, yet you refuse to come to me that you may have life."
Exactly.
Very strong words.
Very strong words. Those scriptures are the basis of everything. If we can't find him in there, what's wrong with us? Yeah, so we're adding to our information, knowledge, and our foundation, our base, that strengthens us and in each other as best we can. I would give you a suggestion. Because we're going through 2 Samuel rather hard, it's going to be difficult, but I'm not going to go through too hard that you can't follow me. I'll hit these chapters over and over and over again, because I have to go through chapter 15 alone 3 times just to get everything out of it. I would suggest you read it. Not right now. Over the next few months, read 2 Samuel 15 through 21. Just read it. So just you familiarize yourself with the story. So then we can go back through it. And as we're going through, because note, when I go through 15, I'm also going through 21 at the same time. I know it's confusing, but I have to do that. Because we're going to narrow itself down. We're bookending this because they match one another. 15 is the reverse of 21. 16 is the reverse of 20. You get the point? 17 is the reverse of 18. They all narrow themselves down to a culminating point. But I have to go through them. It won't be easy, but it won't be too hard either. But just familiarize yourself with the story. This should be a rather interesting ride. Any questions, anything else? God bless you with the rest of a good Shabbat.